Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Vedant Patel is a communications professional who spent the past 13 years working in and around public service. He most recently served as principal deputy spokesperson at the State Department, and before that was a spokesperson at the White House. He's also worked on Capitol Hill, on national political campaigns, and at the Democratic National Committee. These days, he's a senior vice president at SKDK, where he helps organizations navigate media, messaging, crisis communications, and high-stakes public affairs, of which there is no shortage. So, Vedant, thank you so much for being here with me today.
I'm really glad to be here, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Of course, I appreciate you taking the time. And so we'll dive right in so I can begin my psychoanalysis of you.
There we go.
Where did you grow up? How were you raised? And how did all of this kind of shape your value system?
Sure, that's a great place to start. So I was actually born in India and moved to the United States at a very young age, about when I was one. Grew up in Northern California in San Jose, was raised by, you know, immigrant parents who were also, new to this country and who for a good chunk of my life, worked in service industry jobs. And I think that really instilled a deep value of, just hard work and gratitude. And I think over the course of my life and upbringing, I just sort of saw how public institutions could open doors. I'm a product of public schools, a product of public universities. And I think in my parents' own story, I really saw how potent this notion was that the United States was a place, it was a country that was the envy of the world and was truly someplace that was filled and primed for opportunity. I think that just continues to stick with me. And it's something I keep in the back of my mind.
Yeah. So then how did you end up finding your way into a public service career?
Yeah.
Is it a direct path for you?
No, it absolutely was not. It absolutely was not. I had always thought for most of my life that I actually was going to enter medicine and be a doctor. Super love keeping the cliches alive as a South Asian, and so that honestly had been my my goal for a good chunk of my adolescent life and a good amount of time in college. But I think I always had the bug and it just sort of festered and continued to grow over time. In high school, actually, I did sort of a high school, for lack of a better word, student advisory internship type of thing with my local hometown member of Congress. And I think that just really, that sort of was the first entrance in like, oh, wow, you can do this as a thing. Like there are people whose this is their jobs. And then, when I moved back home after graduating college, I sort of was a little bit of a lost soul and it was sort of figuring, as many people are, I think, when they graduate college. And so, was figuring out what I wanted to do. And I reached back out to that member of Congress's office and sort of, moved home, graduated college. I don't know what to do, but I'm really interested in government and public service and politics. And they were going through some staff transition and there was an opportunity in there in the district office. And, one thing led to another. And I guess the rest is history. And I've never really looked back since then.
What did your parents say, though? How did they feel at that moment?
So it's interesting. I think like any, like any immigrant parent or maybe even any parent writ large, there's an uncomfort and maybe even borderline a fear of the unknown, right? And so there definitely was a lot of apprehension and concern about the fact that this is, kind of uncharted territory for, at least for me. And it's not really something that's super linear. It's not something in which there's a clear formula, like, you go to med school or you go to law school or whatever, and there's sort of like a clear equation that you can try and follow. And so I think that created a lot of apprehension, a lot of concern. They probably weren't thrilled at the onset, but I'm a big believer in, life finds a way. And I certainly found a way to make it work. And with every job and with every, thing that I've done in my career where I've grown, I think my hope is that, they get it. And, I think we're good now. I think we're good now, but
I don't think they should be too disappointed in you.
I think we're good now, but I will say, I think 13, 14 years ago there, it's just a little bit of a shock and a little bit of a, like, what does this even mean?
Yeah. Well, what does this mean is the question, because if you don't come from a family that is politically connected or has any experience with that. Like, I mean, to this day, I think a lot of my family is like, what was your job? Like, we have no idea what you were doing at the State Department. They don't even really ask. And I also think all parents make sacrifices, right? Because they want to try to give their kids the best life possible, a better life maybe than they had. And particularly for parents who have uprooted and made the choice to come to a new country and braved all of the challenges that come along with that. I'm sure there was a lot of fear and anxiety, and I hope that they are very proud of you for really following your heart and turning your passion into your purpose and your pathway. And I think it's an amazing thing that I would be proud to see my children do one day.
I really appreciate that, and I hope so too. And I think so. But and it's like you said, I think, when you do all these things, when you make all these sacrifices, I think it's your hope that at the end of the day, you're doing all those things ultimately to give your kids some sense of security, whether it's sort of, financial security, career security, some stability, whatever. Like, I don't think. I certainly appreciate that, the apprehension and the concern stemmed from that place of love.
Yeah, of course. So then let's transition into talking about what your career looked like in government. And I think it would be really great just for our listeners to first unpack what are the differences between political appointees and career civil and foreign servants, just for those who are not familiar.
So the roles that I had in the White House and in the State Department were ones that were contingent on, President Biden and Secretary Blinken being the president and the Secretary of State. It was not, as you know, but maybe listeners don't, every presidential administration, there's, a few thousand political appointees across the White House and the various cabinet agencies that really, are there to try and carry out the mission of the president and the various agency heads, and your employment is really contingent on them being in the job. And so, you're sort of guaranteed January 20th at noon till the next January 20th at noon, 4 years down the line. And that's really it. That's really it. And so when President Trump won re-election for this second term, my job and the job of many others was going to come to a conclusion at noon on January 20th, 2025. And that's just sort of how the cookie crumbles. But, break, break, there are tens of thousands of career officials across the White House, across every cabinet agency, at places like USAID and State, there's foreign service officers as well. And they really are the, I think, the backbone, the continuity, and the subject matter experts, and really just offer, institutional support and keeping the institutional trains running on time. I think that's sort of the differing perspective. I mean, politicals will come and go. That's a tale as old as time, but I think it's, career officers and foreign service officers that help keep that institutional quality alive.
People love to talk about institutional memory. That was one of the first terms that I learned when I came into state. And I hope this isn't an oversimplification, but to add to what you said, I mean, like, if we boil it down, politicals are coming in and given their jobs because they're like, we're on board and we want to be a part of actualizing the vision of this president, which is a part of whatever party's in power, this administration, right? Career civil servants are hired to do a particular job in a particular office. They can make changes if they want to. They can apply for other jobs within the agency or other federal agencies, but they're hired for that job. And foreign service officers, which I think many people don't even know the difference between civil and foreign service. Foreign service officers, kind of like military, are like trained to serve and have assignments all around the world. And so we invest nationally like so much into making these people capable of carrying out our foreign policy across administrations, across generations. Like the point is that they are supposed to become the expertise with kind of the bird's eye view and also the depth of knowledge in so many different topics and regions. And so then when we talk about what we're seeing happen today, the day that we're recording, July 11th, I just read an article on Reuters right before this that talked about, it says the State Department will start firing more than 1,350 US-based employees today, and that 1,100 of them will be civil service officers and 246 foreign service officers. And I think for people to understand what the roles of these individuals is supposed to be, like it's not the same as turning over political appointees. These are people who are hired to implement whatever the administration's vision is, but also to provide their expertise based on often decades of knowledge and experience of a particular topic.
And 100%. And on top of that, I think part of the sort of agreement of their employment is that, you know, you don't need to live your life in these, you know, 2 to 4 year cycles, that your employment, like, as long as you're in good standing, sort of will persist. And, you know, if Foreign Service officers, when I think for a long time in the Foreign Service contract, there was this phrase that, you know, worldwide available, meaning that, you know, you go anywhere in the world, that wherever your next assignment is, wherever your onward is, you go and you serve your country and you do whatever the job is, whether it's at the Truman Building in DC or, you know, literally anywhere in the world. So,
And the point is to have people coming from different perspectives and with different priorities, talking about the same issues to come to the right policy, right?
And beyond that, I think, at least this was my approach, it truly was a partnership. It was a partnership. For me, I will say it was an incredibly humbling experience getting to work with career officers and Foreign Service officers. I think, again, to echo what you said, they offer institutional memory. I think that there is also a bit of a, they can compass on navigating the ins and outs of the building, but the ins and outs of our foreign policy. And they truly are sort of the steady hands of government. I know for me, someone who, you know, when I joined State was new to foreign policy, they were so incredibly helpful in helping me get up to speed on all the issues. And that's how you want it to work. You want there to be deep collaboration between Foreign Service officers and civil service officers and the politicals. You know, and the relationship is supposed to be rooted in a mutual respect and, you know, at least a some sense of collaboration. And I think it's just really sad to see what's happening right now. These are people who, you know, were over the course of my time in government, I saw them more than I probably saw my wife. And, you know, I think what's happening now, laying off career diplomats at a time of just great instability, it's not streamlining government, in my view. It's kneecapping diplomacy. These are people who are deeply involved in the processing of your passports, in interviewing foreigners abroad who may have visas coming to the United States. These are people who de-escalate wars, who strengthen our alliances. I think doing this is really hollowing out our toolkit. Now, look, like, I think it is fair for any president of any party or any secretary of state to come to a conclusion that maybe there are some bureaus and some roles that are no longer fit for purpose. That's totally fine. And that's like a fair conclusion to come to. But then let's invest in these people. Let's train them for roles in bureaus that we do think are fit for purpose. You know, we want more people working on China. We want more people working on AI. We want more people working on these important things, not less. And so if you think that the structure of the State Department, you know, doesn't make sense for whatever you're trying to accomplish, you know, whatever, fair. I'm not, you know, I'm not here to sort of opine on that. But from an HR perspective and a personnel perspective, there is a totally different way to go about this to then try and solve for those things. It's like, okay, if we're not fit for purpose, how do we use these people to become fit for purpose?
Yeah, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And because these are career servants, they could absolutely be retooled or placed in a different bureau or office, even if it's determined that like an entire bureau is not aligned with the president's direction or the administration's direction for foreign policy. So I agree 100%. And furthermore, you know, any of us who have navigated the hiring process also know how challenging it is to hire and to get people on board. It takes a really long time. Some of that is because the process is broken, and some of that is because security clearances take time and people have to be vetted. And so I think that it's important to also identify the fact that it's going to take a really long time to rehire and replenish our diplomatic corps.
And I think we have a generation of young people right now who are graduating college or who are getting ready to graduate college, who are making decisions about their careers or making decisions about what they study. And, you know, maybe 10 months ago, joining the Foreign Service was really at the top of their to-do list or top of their goals. And now you have to think that, you know, they are probably rethinking that. And I think the downstream consequences of that, I don't even think we'll really fully understand 10, 15, 20 years down the line when the current, top diplomats, career diplomats of this country, are retired or no longer working,
And we do have
that's
a
when you,
problem. We do have an aging
right.
workforce. And so that's another big challenge you're pointing out. Okay, so pivoting a bit to your experience recently as a spokesperson, you were in the position of often having to articulate and defend policies that you didn't create. You were the messenger, right? You're not just like coming up with a policy and then articulating it to the press. But you're also a human being with personal views on things. So how did you handle being in that position and at times taking the heat?
So I think the first thing is just you have to remember at the end of the day that first and foremost, always you are staff. I've worked for a lot of different elected officials over the course of my career. I've worked in a lot of different places, and the one thing that I have always tried to keep in mind, and the one thing that I always also try to make clear with young people who, may or may not, fully agree with things that various elected officials are doing, especially if they work for them, is like, look, it's not your name on the door. I think if you have a desire and hope to run for office and make decisions and sort of be in that role, it's a free country and you can do that. And I encourage anybody to do that. I think we need more good, smart people running for office. But in the role of staff, you aren't speaking for yourself. You're representing an institution or a country or an elected official. And so I just don't think that one of the core tenets of public service is necessarily self-expression. I think it's about stewardship. It's really not about my personal points of view. And I think, depending on what your relationship is with your principal or your organization, you can say, this is what I think and have the robust debate about the policy. But then ultimately, again, I think what it goes back to is that you are, it's not your name on the door, I think. And so you, and every, look, everybody has their own sort of guardrails of what they are comfortable with in that regards, and I'm not here to judge anybody else's sort of what they're comfortable with, but for me, I was always very comfortable with that delineation, and that I have a job to do, and my job is to go out and be a spokesperson and to figure out a media plan and a communication strategy and work with reporters to make sure that this fill in the blank issue is reflected in the best way possible, even if I happened to disagree with it or not.
But still, you end up being the one who is in the position of having people fire at you. So I imagine that must have been challenging. Are you just like a pretty calm person, or did you have to learn to cope with that stress?
I just try not to take some of that stuff super personally. I think, at least in the context of reporters, I think it's important for reporters to ask tough questions and to, really try and, pressure test the things that any administration is doing, whether it's a Democrat, whether it's a Republican, whatever. I think that is the job of a free press, and I think it's important to let them do that job. And so I think tough questions, hard questions are fair. You sort of try not to take any of the interactions or engagements personally. I certainly didn't. And, again, people are entitled to their opinions on social media or on whatever. And what I've always tried to stay focused on is just, doing the job and focusing on the work.
And I like that you use the word stewardship because I think that really does capture your role as a public servant. And it's a heavy thing as well. Like, it's a big responsibility, whether you're on the clock or off the clock, you're always representing your government. And that was something that I thought about all the time when I was a part of the civil service. And ultimately, I really just like saying what I think, and that's why maybe I'm better off right now as a podcast host rather than a steward of the government, because that it's a sacrifice that you make when you take on that job and that responsibility. You have now your words really matter, and you have the opportunity to really make a difference with them, and you also have to sacrifice the opportunity to share your personal view on certain topics in certain venues.
Absolutely.
It's
That's right.
hard.
And I think it's important that, you have that conversation with yourself and you sort of determine that this is what makes sense for me. And I think, there's a mutual respect for that, just like there's a mutual respect for am gonna stay in and keep doing this, or
Right.
this one issue that I might disagree with is really not enough for me to stop doing this job that I
Right.
think is still really important and I enjoy,
Yeah,
right?
and
I think
everybody has to
there's
make their
so
own
much nuance.
determination.
There's so
Yeah.
much nuance. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so speaking of so much nuance, let's talk about the Democratic Party, because it's not a secret that you're a Democrat, you're a political appointee, right?
Yep.
What are your thoughts on the future of the Democratic Party and what the party needs at this moment?
So, look, I think over the course of the next however many, months, year it is before the 2028 primary is in full swing, I think there's going to be lots of conversations about, policy cornerstones and sort of what direction people think that the party needs to go in that sense.
Yeah.
I'm kind of less interested in that, to be honest. I think for me, what is has been apparent, what continues to be apparent, is that I think the American people they're interested in authenticity. And so I
Yeah.
think that's certainly something that I will be keeping an eye out for. But beyond that, it's just still, it's very early to tell. I think people are trying to read into things and various election results that have happened around the country. And I think it's one, it's super early, but I also do think that, electorates and places are different, and that you can't sort of, not everything is apples to apples. But I think most importantly, I'm interested in seeing somebody who is authentic. I'm interested in seeing somebody who, of course, has a vision for the country, but also, this isn't something that we talk about enough, but has a vision for the public servants and the people who are going to be working around them, whether they
Yeah.
are politicals, whether they're career, whether they're foreign service, what have you. These are, people make sacrifices to do these things, to join campaigns,
Yeah.
to work these jobs. And so somebody who is keeping in that in mind as well. I don't know. That probably wasn't a good answer.
No, it's honest. It's honest, but I think I have a follow-up though. Does the party have a messaging problem?
I don't necessarily think that's true, because I think you can't paint like
Yeah.
the Democratic Party
Yeah.
message with sort of a broad brush stroke, right? There is, of course, a national conversation, but if you talk about some of the recent elections that we've seen, whether it be New York City, whether it be New Jersey, whether it be Virginia, I think those are candidates who had really, really strong in their message and sort of were authentic and had conviction and tailored their message and their platforms to the concerns of the electorate in those places, which are not, and those places are not apples to apples, right?
Right.
And so and
Yeah.
so I think that is really important. I think and that's where I think I sort of go back to authenticity. I think it's pretty clear people want someone who's authentic. People want, I think always it's going to be really important to thinking about, working class families and being responsive to an economic agenda. I think we've seen that time and time again, more than foreign policy, that that is like a more potent decision maker when it comes to elections. And I think, in a totally unrelated sense too, something that I am super curious about and paying very close attention to is, we do have a lot to address in the foreign policy and national security space. And,
Yeah. Yeah.
It's never, everyone thinks like, oh, this might be a foreign policy election. It never really is.
Right.
But whoever is running for president, right, they are going to have to be thinking about, okay, how do we go back to NATO? How do we go back to some of our allies and partners? And, what can we do to make it so that, American foreign policy isn't necessarily slingshotting between these two very different places, and sort of,
Yeah.
the instability of what that means for some of our allies and partners and some of these institutions like NATO and the
Right.
G7. In the first transition to from Trump to Biden, I think there was a little bit of America's back, we got this, we have a seat at the table, here's all that we stand for and all that we believe. That's great. I think that there are a lot of partners around the world who are probably very much in the space of fooled me once, shame on you, fooled me twice, shame on me. And I think they are very concerned that there's going to be multiple sequels of this movie, right? And
Yeah.
so I think, what can we do to reassure partners and allies that America is going to continue to have a seat at the table in a way that is mutually beneficial without making up things that, it's just not something that you can promise. So
Yeah.
that's something that I'm going to be very curious to watch.
Yeah, same. And so since we're basically just talking about the future this entire time. On a different note, you just became a father not too
I
long
did.
ago.
I did.
Congratulations. That's a
Thank you.
huge, huge change and a huge gift. What has been the impact on your thinking about not only your personal life, but your career? How has fatherhood changed your perspective?
That's a great question. It's honestly
Is it TBD?
no, I don't think it's TBD. I think it's and you know, I think initially so I think there's sort of two sort of areas of thought that are in immense conflict, maybe. One, I think it's added a lot of clarity and urgency about sort of thinking about the country and thinking about the world around me and you know, what you know, just incredibly concerned about the kind of place that my daughter is going to inherit, just in terms of what is going on, right? And so immensely concerned as a parent with a very young child, as I'm sure many people are. I doubt that I am alone in thinking about that. I think the other thing is just sort of somebody who kind of has, you know, especially for the past 6, 7 years, been in really intense, time-consuming jobs. It's really, I think, reminded me that time is your most valuable resource, and sort of how you spend it does matter. I think for me, it's this very like troubling thought that, you know, I fully recognize that there is a lot of pain around the country right now. You know, having to leave a job on January 20th meant that I was able to be at home for pretty much the first, you know, just, you know, job hunting takes a while and all the things, and so was able to be at home for the first 4 or 5 months of my daughter's life in a
That's
way that
amazing.
just really wouldn't have been possible, even with parental leave, had, you know, I remained in government, had sort of I stayed at state or whatever. And so it's a silver lining, I guess, but it's also like, because it pains me to see what's happening. It pains me to see what's happening around the country. It pains me to see, just going back to the events of today and yesterday, it pains me what's happening to a building that I love dearly, and to colleagues and friends. It sucks. But you know, it also, I have this time with my daughter that I wouldn't have had otherwise, and we have a great bond. And so I don't know, you're sort of figuring that all out.
There's room for all of that to be true, right? Like I think of parenting as peaceful chaos. My house, I have three boys. It's perpetual chaos, but I also feel like a deep sense of peace and purpose being a part of my family because it's kind of like no matter what you do at work in your career, you can do your very best and you might have impact on a huge scale or on a small scale. You may or may not achieve your goals, but like you're always going to be an important figure in your child's life and you're raising someone who is going to go out into the world and have their own impact. And so I feel like in that way it's so fulfilling and it's for me been like very grounding in moments where other things feel so chaotic and uncertain.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Well, welcome to
I
the
couldn't agree
club.
more. Thank
Welcome to the
you.
club. I'm
Thank
so
you.
happy for you that you're getting to have this experience and that it's a silver lining for you at a challenging moment.
Absolutely.
So my last question for you today is, what does it mean to you to be an American, and what do you think it requires of us at this moment?
You know, I think for me, it has meant a few things. I think first, in that just believing in a promise that this country, though imperfect, I think is always capable of progress. And it is something that, you know, I heard President Biden, but also Secretary Blinken say a lot in my time of working for him, especially when, you know, you get questions from reporters or other countries about like, who are you to tell us that, you know, we need to improve on X, Y, and Z in our country? Like, look, doesn't America have fill in the blank challenge? And I think it's just it's not sweeping those challenges under the rug and having this conviction that as imperfect as our country is, as deeply imperfect as our country is, that we are capable of progress and capable of trying to address some of those issues and trying to tackle them head on. And I think that also means contributing to something bigger than yourself, contributing to democracy, to your community, to something shared. And it's why I'm so glad you've created this space for people to talk about public service and their experiences and why it's so important to them, I think it requires showing up also. And for everybody, that's different, but
Right.
it does require showing up, whether that's voting, whether that's listening, whether that's staying engaged, even
Yeah.
when it's hard. I do think to be an American is something that is something that is required of us.
Yeah, and it's a practice, right? Like we don't just have a democracy, we practice our democracy, and in
Absolutely.
doing so, we also make things possible for others. What does your practice of service look like at this moment?
Well, as you said, these days I'm in the private sector. I think I'm at it's two front. One, I'm always somebody who's going to stay super engaged and stay paying attention to things and trying to be involved in the party. And I'm not somebody who is sort of, going to just sort of, take a back seat. And I think it's just out of character for me. And then, just on a more personal level, look, the firm I'm at, SKDK, is one. One of the reasons that I am there is because there is an alignment in values of, what we want to see when it comes to the future of this country and the kinds of clients and projects and things that we take on. And so, it is not public service in the sense that, I'm working in government or working on a campaign, but I do think sort of the values are there and the propagation of those values are there. And I think that, that was important to me in my job hunt as well. It's not sort of something I thought that was going to be necessarily really important, but I think as you sort of go through the process, you kind of learn that a little bit about yourself. And I think sort of where I landed was that actually I do think this is something, is that would mean a lot to me. So.
Yeah, and I think going back to everything that's happening today, the public sector's loss is also the private sector's gain because I'm seeing a lot of brilliant, service-oriented, scrappy, creative individuals going into the private sector with a public service sort of ethos and bringing all of those incredible skills and experiences with them. And I hope that one day there will be a moment where some of those people will cycle back into government and bring new experiences with them from the private sector and build that public-private partnership as well.
Absolutely. 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 I think that's 100% right.
And, I'm just forcing us to end on a positive note because
Yeah.
it's too sad otherwise.
Yeah.
But listen, I want to thank you so much for sitting here and talking with me today, for being as thoughtful, reflective, and honest as you've been. And I also want to thank you so much for your service to our country.
Thank you. And likewise, you as well. I really appreciate you making the space for people and just really looking forward to staying in touch.
We will. Thank you so much.